From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Passover starts on Tuesday and is observed for 7 days. We reach Joe Nathan, an insatiably curious researcher of Jewish food culture, to talk about the significance of this important holiday when it comes to food. Her new culinary exploration of Jewish cooking is called King Solomon's Table. You use the example of King Solomon's wives to describe how food migrates. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, first of all, if there was a King Solomon, he had, according to the Bible, 700 wives and 300 concubines. And if you've ever been to temples or palaces in the East, in Asia, you always find the concubines are right outside, sort of at the foot of the palace. And these women came from the neighboring then-known world, from all the different countries. And my guess is they brought with them, of course, food. And the food would have had their spice interpretations of dishes. And clearly, he had insatiable appetites if he had 700 wives. He was known to want to bring everything, spices, jewels, stones, to embellish and to feed people in the palace and in the temple of Jerusalem. So I realized that from the get-go, Jews have been going out from wherever they live to find new foods is something to sustain all of us. And that's been for thousands of years. It's been the same story. And of course, these foods were in line with the dietary laws, of course. You know, in my mind, that's what makes Jewish food food. Jewish food, it's like this wandering aspect, the insatiable thirst for the new. And the third thing that seems to me that's so important is the fact that Jews were kicked out of so many places, as so many immigrants to our country were. And so they had to adapt the dietary laws to whatever new terrain they lived in all over the world. And those are, to me, the three components of Jewish food. You know, it started probably earlier than King Solomon. It probably started with Abraham, but somehow King Solomon's Table seemed a better title. And so that's what we did.
One of the examples that you give about a migrating dish is cheesecake and its Roman provenance.
Right. Well, you know, it might have been earlier, but we know that Apicius had a lot of cheesecake recipes. You know, it would have been originally more like a whey cheese, more like a cottage cheese, or maybe saltier, because they needed that salt before refrigeration to take care of the cheese so that it could be eaten all year round. So they would salt it, and then it would become dried, much like the Bedouin cheeses today. So there would be cheesecakes, not necessarily sweet. And eventually, there was a cheesecake that was known as the Jewish cheesecake in ancient Rome. And there's even a recipe for it in Apicius. Later, at Christmas, people in Rome would eat what they called a Jewish cheesecake. And of course, cheesecake has been something that Jews have eaten throughout history, and we can find different variations of it wherever Jews roamed. In New York cheesecake is considered Jewish cheesecake.
So interesting. Now let's get specific for Passover, which to me is the ultimate celebration of migration and survival. Many families begin their Seder meal with some form of hard-boiled egg. You have an unusual recipe from Spain.
Well, actually, it's from Corfu. You cook the eggs for a long time, and then you cook the spinach down. I serve it lukewarm over the egg. And I grew up in a German-Jewish household. We never had egg as the first course of the meal. My husband's family always had an egg in salt water. And, you know, the egg is really a symbol of life. also of the temple and of fecundity, all kinds of things. Don't forget that Passover was at one time the new year of the Jews. So this is a very symbolic food, but it's also, there are more eggs in the spring than any time of the year, which is why you have Easter eggs and why there's so many eggs at Passover. When I was in Rome, I was at this with a woman whose family was from Ancona, Italy, but they originated from Corfu. And she made this egg with its spinach, and it was so delicious. I made it as a variation instead of our hard-boiled egg at one Passover. And everybody loved it so much that this year I'm going to be at my daughter's in L.A. for Passover, and I was told I have to bring the hard-boiled eggs with this spinach.
The thing that's interesting to me about this recipe is the eggs are sort of cooked twice. First, you just boil them.
Right.
So you can take them out of the shell. But then you reboil them in a broth almost.
Right. And that's what makes them inside. They'll be totally creamy.
Because they're cooking in that broth, and the broth just gets absorbed into the egg.
Right, exactly.
So let's talk a bit about haroset. Remind us what it symbolizes.
Well, the haroset symbolizes the mortar that built the buildings that the slaves built in ancient Egypt. And it was the color of it. But it was also a dipping sauce in Babylonia. And it was the last of the symbolic foods to come into the Passover service. So it was something that when you had a banquet, you'd have some sort of a dipping sauce of much like a condiment that we would have, or even when people would eat ketchup, but you know, like a chutney maybe. The earliest ones, well, one of them was just cooking down dates to become a honey, like a date honey, which you can buy prepared today in Middle Eastern stores, which is called a date jam. You would chop up walnuts inside it. But then there were others, like Egyptian ones, that had dates and raisins and nuts, or Eastern European Jews that didn't have dates would have apples and nuts. And then there were all kinds of Spanish ones where you can sort of trace a haroset to trace the journey of the family that makes the haroset. In Spain, they used to have haroset balls, mostly with dates and nuts. And then they went, when Jews were kicked out of Spain, the Jews that went to Morocco from Spain, they continued the nuts and the dates. The Jews that went to the United States from Spain and Portugal couldn't get dates, so they had apples and raisins and nuts, and they made them into balls, which they were the known haroset in America until the 20th century.
And you say that at your Passover, you serve several different kinds.
Well, to me, the Passover haroset shows the diaspora of the Jews and the wandering of the Jews. And I think it's so fascinating because Passover is not just a meal. You learn so much at this holiday because it's been around for so long. And so you can learn, you know, the chestnut haroset from Ferrara. It's important to me to tell these stories. There's one that's a Moroccan one that's dipped in cinnamon, then served in France today. And there's a Maine haroset with dried blueberries and several without any nuts because so many people have nut allergies today. So it's kind of fun.
Talk to me a bit about quinoa and how its arrival on the culinary scene has enhanced the Passover table.
Uh-huh. Well, quinoa is kind of like a rice or like a grain, but it isn't a grain. It's the rabbis have said that, yes, we could use it. And of course, it comes from Peru, which probably didn't have many Jews. I mean, every place almost has a few Jews. But that is able to be used at Passover. And I have a wonderful recipe in King Solomon's Table for pecans and squash and quinoa. It's really good. Because at a Passover Seder, you don't want to worry about those vegetarians. So I always have one dish like that or a lot of vegetable dishes so I don't have to worry about them and have a lot of cold salads, cooked salads. It just makes it much easier.
Because we tend to eat so much matzah during the Passover period, mm-hmm. matzah brei, the fried matzah, is a favorite breakfast dish for a lot of people. You have an unusual recipe in the book in which you add spices.
You know, all these chefs are doing all these great things. A chef in New York that had a restaurant, his name is Joe Doe. So what he does is he deep fries the matzah, and then he adds spices like turmeric and cayenne and black pepper and minced garlic and celery seed. And it's really a nice variation. I serve that at my Seder with, of course, the regular matzah and the shmura matzah.
Many of us become addicted to horseradish sauce during the Passover period. And you talk about one beet horseradish sauce, which is Polish and has an very interesting and kind of disturbing Easter connection.
Let me just tell you the story behind that. You know, there's white horseradish and red horseradish. And until last year, I never thought about the difference. So I was doing a demonstration at a food store, the Giant Eagle in Pittsburgh. And as I walked to the grocery store, there was a huge pile of horseradish. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's all this for Passover. And I was doing this class, and a woman came to the class, and she told me she was Polish and that she was the one who made the horseradish for her church. And she made it red, and she made it red because it was the blood of Christ. And it occurred to me, number one, in France, which is the center of horseradish, the horseradish was white horseradish. It might have had some cream, but the Jews made it basically with a little bit of vinegar in it, but also just white horseradish. As the Jews went east towards Poland, they started using red horseradish, and meaning that they added beets to the horseradish. And, you know, they would buy it. Nobody had prepared foods. They would buy it at farmers' markets. I'm sure people never talked to each other. They didn't know that it represented the blood of Christ. So they liked the flavor of it and they ate it. And I'll bet you anything that practically nobody knew that story.
You know why I love this story so much? Because when you look at the celebration of springtime festivals, mm-hmm. you see so many traditions that weave in and out of each other. And this is just one more.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was just amazed when I realized it. And I said, of course, she's right. And then I thought, wait a minute, I've never had red horseradish in France. And of course, the reason Jews used horseradish is that Jews lived in the Mediterranean until about the 10th or 11th century. And as they went north from the Mediterranean, they were in the south of France and the north of Italy. It was about 400 miles north, and they went to Alsace-Lorraine and Champagne, where Rashi was, okay, a little bit later.
The famed rabbi.
Exactly, the famous rabbi. And there was no bitter herbs of romaine lettuce, or just maror in Arabic means marora, which is just any bitter green that's growing in the springtime. So there, it was too cold for anything really to grow then, but horseradish root grew then at Passover. So they use the horseradish root. You know, as I said, Jews have always been adapters to the dietary laws, even if it's just in the back of your brain, you know, what you are and what kind of Judaism you observe. So that's how they started with horseradish sauce for the Passover Seder. It was one of the symbolic foods, the bitter herbs, the bitterness of slavery.
As always, so interesting talking to you. Thank you so much, Joan.
Well, thank you, and happy Passover.
Joan Nathan's new cookbook is King Solomon's Table. While we're on the subject of Passover, let's spend a moment on kosher wine. I'm going to give Lou Amder a call at Lou Wine Shop and Tastings in Los Feliz.
Hi, it's Lou Wine Shop.
Hi, Lou. It's Evan.
Hi.
Hi. You have time to talk to me about kosher wine?
Yes.
I'm kind of fascinated by this subject because when I think about Manischewitz, the ubiquitous, super sweet kosher wine that for decades defined the genre, you think about the ceremony where you have to drink 4 glasses of wine before the meal even begins, man, that's a hard hangover of regret.
And yet it satisfied generations of American Jews.
It's true.
You know that in the old world, especially in Northern Europe, the wine that our people made was from raisins.
So like Amarone.
I mean, these were full raisins. So this was, you know, raisins you would eat. Jews need wine. They need it on a weekly basis. And if there's no wine trade from south to north, what do? You're screwed. You can use mead, but people wanted wine. So raisin wines was quite ubiquitously made. And in the New World, there were Concord grapes. I think Concord's actually a hybrid grape. I think it's a cross between a European grape and an American native grape. Those early wines made from Concord, for example, that was a grape that was available and were made in that style. It wasn't like there's anything in the Torah that says sacramental wine has to be sweet. But I think it came from deprivation of real wine, and geez, we need some wine. Let's make something out of raisins. At least we have some wine. So those wines obviously were sweet.
When did things start to change? When did people say, hey, we have wonderful varietals. Why can't we try something a little different?
Has that happened? That's happened. The situation in Israel is, I think, really hobbled by the centuries-long diminishment or diminution of winemaking. Even in Lebanon, there are some autochthonous grape varieties still. In Israel, there are none, at least that we know of. What you have instead is a wine industry that has planted, obviously, international varieties because there's nothing left of those biblical wine grapes, at least in the Holy Land.
But there are certain requirements that a wine needs to fulfill in order to be kosher. Do those requirements impede the quality of the wine?
Well, there's two types of kosher wine. There is kosher wine that has been observed by observant Jews, people who are designated to be wine watchers. They observe the winemaking process from the picking of the grapes to the time the wine is finished fermentation and is bottled. And those wines, as long as they are always in the hands of observant Jews, so you go to a kosher restaurant and an observant Jew can pour you one of these wines, but as soon as those hands leave the supply chain of observant Jews, those wines are no longer fit for consumption by Orthodox Jews, at least. For those wines to function in a wider world of commerce, they have to be boiled. Mavushal is the descriptor for those wines. So Mavushal wines, which are the most commonly found kosher wines because they can be sold anywhere, even I could sell them, have to be boiled. And they were boiled because the idea, at least at the level of rabbinical teaching, was that by boiling the wines, you render them unfit for pagan use. If you boil the wine, you know that the pagans never touched it, and you feel safe to drink it as long as the enclosure hasn't been tampered with. Straight kosher wines that are not mavushal do not have to be boiled, but you'll only get them if the entire supply chain is guaranteed to be of observant Jews.
The idea of wine being boiled just seems like such a heresy. Is there something used now like flash pasteurization?
Yes, just to back up one second, there is a long tradition in Europe, in France in particular, of making vin cuit, which is a cooked wine, and those wines can be absolutely extraordinary. It's an old, old technique, and traditionally what's done is not the wine itself is cooked, but the fresh juice of the grapes is cooked, sometimes in the presence of herbs and spices, and made into a wine. And a vin cuit, like I described, could itself be kosher, as long as you could guarantee that all the processes from harvesting to bottling was kosher. So no, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with making a boiled wine, especially if you start with the must. However, the wines I'm describing are typically sweet wines and sometimes aromatized with herbs and spices. So they don't really conform to our understanding of what a table wine should be. They're more specialty wines. But yes, boiling the wine, if your goal is to make a dry table wine, mutes the wine and messes with the organoleptic characteristic of the wine. One basic thing you can do is render the wine kind of stewed or pruny because you've oxidized the wine and made it such. You mentioned flash pasteurization as well. Of course, once you flash pasteurize a wine, you have rendered it completely inert biologically. Then it's now also fit for kosher consumption. I do not find it convincing personally. There's a reason why no conventional winemaker is seeking flash pasteurization for any reason, because obviously it mutes the flavor as well. So it is a technique that obviously comes from the juice world that can also be applied to wine, but even flash pasteurized wines will mute the flavor. That's the sad situation for Mavushal wines.
Do you carry any kosher wines for the Passover season?
I do. Every so often we get so little call for it that we don't stock, typically. It's a special order for us. There's one producer who I like very, very much named Jeff Morgan, who's been working on making good kosher wines for a while. These are Mavushal wines. His winery is called Covenant. I like those wines, but we have so few calls for that I don't stock it. I only on special order.
Where are the Covenant wines made?
Napa.
And what kind of varietals is he
working
with?
Well, the wine that I was talking about specifically that Jeff makes is actually a Napa Cabernet. And if you want a suave, full-bodied Napa Cabernet, the Covenant wine, if you're craving that with a meal, Covenant wines can be just great.
This has been so interesting. Every time I talk to you, I learn so much.
I try not to be too pedantic, but I'm really glad we had a chat.
Me too. Take care.
Thanks, man. Bye-bye.
Lou Amdur is the owner of Lou Wine Shop and Tastings in Los Angeles. Next up, we ride along on one dude's quest for the perfect chocolate chip cookie. That's when the show continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Not too chewy, not too crispy, with a nice dough to chip ratio and the right amount of butter and sugar. Finding the perfect chocolate chip cookie has sent enthusiasts on lengthy missions. Our contributor Gideon Brower went on such a quest in LA.
My friend Jack Cheeseborough is a hippie. Not a nouveau hippie, not a former hippie, an actual hippie. In the late 60s, he moved to San Francisco to play music, and he later spent time driving around the country in a brightly painted Volkswagen bus he named Althea, after the Grateful Dead song. I told Althea I was free. He's worked as a DJ, a musician, in film production, and at a pawn shop. He lived in Los Angeles in the 80s and 90s, but most of his recent career has involved boarding and training dogs in the DC area. Jack's always been more interested in music, books, and film than money. And at 70, he's still happy to crash on a friend's floor when he's traveling.
Cool.
He's laid back about most things, but he's surprisingly particular about food. Jack starts every visit to L.A. with a pilgrimage to Jody Maroney's Sausage Kingdom. And a trip to buy tequila can turn into an odyssey involving several liquor stores before Jack finds a bottle he deems acceptable. On recent trips to L.A., Jack's been visiting bakeries in an obsessive search for the perfect chocolate chip cookie, or brownie. His blend of zen and fussiness makes him a unique and unpredictable food critic. And he's just fun to hang out with. So I ask if I can tag along on his next cookie shopping spree. He says yes, then suggests that, quote, some weed may be helpful. When Jack comes to town, we try to schedule our cookie crawl, but it's challenging. Monday, he's taking LSD in a friend's backyard. Tuesday, he's working on his tan by another friend's pool. Wednesday looks good, but not in the morning, which is reserved for meditation, yoga, and chanting. This is a ritual Jack has observed for decades, and it takes a full 2 hours. When I arrive, where Jack's crashing at our friend Christine's place, I find him wearing two colorful plaid shirts, one over the other, talking on the phone.
Are they identical twins or fraternal? Yeah, okay.
He's tall and lanky and looks a bit like Peter Fonda, with dark hair and a white horseshoe mustache.
Okay, well, I'll get in touch with you later. I gotta wiggle.
I've brought a list of restaurants and bakeries recommended by friends on Facebook, who responded to my question about cookies with more interest and enthusiasm than any heartfelt message I've ever posted in the past. Fortified with a list, and with Lactaid pills to counter my own lactose intolerance, we set out in Jack's rental car to find LA's ultimate cookie or brownie. Jack tackles one key question right away.
I don't think it would be fair to judge some of these baked items on hash and some not.
No.
No. So maybe I just better leave off the hash.
The next question, what for Jack is the ultimate cookie?
A pale pastry is not worth eating. 95% of the time, I can tell by looking at it whether I'm going to be able to eat it. There's got to be some crunch on the skin or, you know, on the outside, but...
What about crumble?
Crumble is okay. You know, your finest Bianqui chocolate chip cookies will crumble on you.
I'd never heard that term before, Bianqui, but it would become something of a mantra throughout our journey.
Bianqui means well-cooked, literally. It means brown, if not burnt, slightly. Bianqui, I think it was originally applied to croissants.
So is it really just a matter of baking your pastries a little longer?
And at a little higher temperature, I think. So you got to burn them somehow.
Our tasting adventure begins in Larchmont Village, a stretch of boutiques selling artisanal eyeglasses, sneakers, and coffee. Even the parking here is artisanal in the sense of small batch, precious, and hard to find. Oh, okay. Our first stop is Aaron McKenna's bakery.
I like a brownie bite and the most well-done chocolate chip cookie you have in the house.
Like all the best critics, we do the actual tasting outside the restaurant in the car.
Okay, this cookie, it's gooey. It doesn't have any crunch to it at all. It just drops like it's
was that is that my half of the cookie that you're rubbing through your fingers like that?
Sorry. It has a flavor to it that you don't associate with a chocolate chip cookie. It's like, it tastes kind of like granola.
Mm-hmm.
And the brownie is, that brownie is the kind of thing that it's all too ubiquitous.
Yeah.
It's like gummy. Something you might get at a 7-Eleven. I mean, I can see why people like them. It's sweet, and it does have a kind of a loud so-called chocolate flavor, but it's not really chocolate. It's like bogus chocolate. Okay, there's so much for Larchmont.
Okay.
So we move on. Surely a truly transcendent cookie is just a stop or two away.
Is that a half-eaten apple in your ashtray?
Yes.
Obviously, you're quite
something
the gourmand.
Make you nervous about that?
No.
I mean, most, you know, a lot of it's protected by the skin still.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind.
Are you going to start
cleansing my palate with this old apple? Yes.
Oh, my God.
Several of my friends had recommended milk jar cookies on Wilshire Boulevard. The mommy blog, Oh Lovely Day, calls it, quote, the cutest place with the best cookies ever. So we buy a chocolate chip cookie there and return to our Prius tasting laboratory.
It looks like a pile of cookie dough.
It looks like
it was never cooked.
It looks like a creature from a science fiction film.
Oh, or there's a dog that looks like that. You know, one of those.
Oh, yeah, like a
Shih Tzu or a part of Sharpei, yeah.
Yeah, it has a little bit of a Sharpei look.
Just it has a lot of extra
formed and soft. All right.
Okay.
I'm going to break a part of it open.
Has a lot of chocolate chips. Okay, here we go. Oh. I'm sorry.
Jack opens his door and spits the best cookie ever out onto the street.
That bad?
It's just like cookie dough. It's just exactly how it looks. You know?
Okay.
Like, gook. I know, I would like to cleanse my palate with a bite from one of those cookies that's in the door there in the bag, if you don't mind.
These are supplemental cookies?
It turns out that Jack has brought a few cookies he tasted yesterday, including one he loved, from Go Get 'em Tiger in Larchmont Village. We pull over to try it.
I will say that if I needed to cleanse my palate from a chocolate chip cookie, I would not do it with another chocolate chip cookie.
But the cookie Jack fell hard for yesterday proves less satisfying today.
I don't think being in the car overnight helped this cookie any. I loved this cookie when I first had it.
At our next stop, the cafe called Milk on Beverly Boulevard, we sit outside and try the brownie, which LA Weekly calls one of the best in the city.
Ooh. Oh, they warmed this brownie for us, so it can't be bad. This is one of those brownies that's really wet and gooey on the inside and has a nice crunch on the outside. but it has an overtone of something that might have been in the oven with it. Doesn't taste like chocolate at all. I wouldn't eat the whole thing, even if I was completely ripped and it was 1 a.m. I think we should probably keep wiggling.
We hit the road again, heading ever westward like two cookie-loving cowboys, one of whom is moderately lactose intolerant, and the other one of whom has a fondness for gently aging fruit.
You sure I can't tempt you with a bite of this leftover apple?
Turn here.
Now there's some crunch.
We soon confirm what I'd begun to suspect, that Jack's personal cookie ideal, not too moist, not too soft, not too sweet, profoundly bien cuit, is at odds with L.A.'s most admired desserts. Our sample from Clementine, which the blog LAist calls the best cookie ever, but soon proves disappointing.
It has plenty of crunch, too much crunch, caramel crunch. God, it tastes just like a candy bar. I could only eat it if I was really high and it was late at night.
Diddy Reese in Westwood, beloved by generations of UCLA students, fares even worse.
This is something you get out of a machine on the New York State Thruway. If it was ever in the oven, it was like last semester.
By the time we reach Huckleberry in Santa Monica, the floor of Jack's car is littered with small paper bags, each one holding the remains of a sampled and rejected chocolate chip cookie.
I have to warn you, I'm not sure that I can taste any more chocolate chip cookies or brownies.
That's fine with me. Okay, well, let's try this cookie and call it a day.
I'm with you.
Okay, this is the chocolate chip cookie from Huckleberry.
Yeah.
It's nice and crisp on the outside. It has a nice dark color. There's no burn spots on there, but that's too much to ask. Looks like it's not going to be gummy at all. This could be the best chocolate chip cookie of the day. Mmm. Has a good crunch to it. But at this point, oh man, and its chocolate flavor is good too. I'm so over chocolate chip cookies. Even this, couldn't ask for better. I give it a 9 anyway. It's more bien cuit. This is the best of the day.
And so, a dozen cookies into our journey, Jack finally finds what he's looking for. But of course, Jack's perfect cookie may not be mine or yours or LA Weekly's or anyone else's. Figuring out what we love, trying to find it, that's kind of the fun of it. I asked Jack what he thought we'd learned on our quest.
That a good chocolate chip cookie is hard to find. That fresh is always better. That warm will cover a multitude of sins. That there's more to bien cuit than appearances. And that you shouldn't eat chocolate chip cookies all day long without smoking pot.
Okay. I think we can call it a day.
All right.
For Good Food, I'm Gideon Brower.
That piece comes to us from contributor Gideon Brower and KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Got a chocolate chip cookie you love? We'd like to hear about it. Post a photo on Instagram or Facebook and tag us. Our handle is KCRW's Good Food. Now it's time for the market report. Let's find out what Laura's shopping for at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the market report. I'm talking with Zach Walters, who is chef owner of Salt's Cure. And Zach, you're looking past the usual suspects, the bitter greens and stuff, and you're finding really unique items here to make a special dish. Can you describe that?
Yeah, well, what we found is Celtis that we get from Coleman Farms. And it's something that they've been growing for as many years as I've been coming down to the market. And I think that's something that they're constantly trying to put in the forefront of chefs to use because they really like it, and it is extremely unique and has a mild, nutty, and herbaceous flavor that can go with a lot of foods. But it's an odd ingredient that people just kind of need to get educated on a little bit.
Okay, describe what it looks like.
It looks like a very long-stemmed head of romaine lettuce. Very thick stem, which is actually what it's cultivated for, and then some sweet lettuce on top that's very delicious as well, and it does have a flavor of romaine, but it does look something out of Dr. Seuss, I think.
It really does. It's like a long stick with a top knot.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And how did you find it? What attracted you to it?
From them literally just like, you know, pushing it on me for the most part. So we've cooked a couple of dinners with the Coleman family, and every time we've done a dinner, that's basically been an ingredient that they say you have to use. So just kind of by playing around with it and cooking with it, it goes great in the springtime with green garlic. It works well with radishes and anything like that. It does kind of, because it is also known as kind of a Chinese lettuce, it tends to those flavors, but it likes those flavors. It likes chili, it likes ginger, it likes, very heavy, sharp flavors.
Yeah. People may, mistake it for a Brussels sprout stalk that maybe somebody's picked all the Brussels sprouts off of, and here's that stalk left over. Is there anything that grows on the stalk that's picked off, or is it literally just a stem?
It's a stem, but it needs to be cut down. The outside skin of the stem is pretty fibrous. It's kind of hard to break down. So you kind of want to cut down into the heart of it, like a heart of palm in a way. And then from there, you can eat it raw. You can blanch it and saute it very quickly. You can cook it the way that we do, which is just, with a little bit of stock and then make a puree out of it. It's something that you have to use sparingly because it can take over the entire dish, but it can really enhance the quality of anything going on. It does have that like odd umami thing that can happen to it really easily just from all the different flavors that are inside the flavor.
And so after you puree it, then you're serving it cold?
Yeah, we chill it, and then we're serving a marinated octopus on top of it that we're marinating in olive oil and burnt blood oranges. And then we're also crisping. We're dehydrating blood orange to put on as a crisp, and then adding whatever kind of like fun green that we can find around the market. So we're using different types of mustard. Sometimes we're using different types of pea greens or really anything, any chicory that we can find, anything that's not just a lettuce, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it sounds like they're really strong flavors sort of competing and yet complementing each other.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Very strong flavors, but they do compete. And octopus, again, octopus has that, really strong flavor of the sea that's inky and can kind of also overpower a palate and can overpower a plate. So it deserves another strong player with it.
That was Zach Walters. He is chef owner at Salt's Cure in Hollywood, and he is a proponent aficionado of Celtis from Coleman Farm. I'm talking now with Barbara Spencer, who is co-owner of Windrose Farm from Paso Robles. And one of the ingredients Zach was talking about was the frilly mustard that gives that wonderful sort of pungent counterpoint to so many citrus and other things we have at the market. Barbara, you got a bowl full of frilly mustard and other kinds of mustard. So can you describe the difference between the frilly mustard and the regular mustard and how they taste?
Part of it is there's a range of spiciness. Some are more spicy than others, so you almost have to come and do a taste test to see which ones are the ones you're really looking for. He usually gets the Scarlet Frills type or something we grow, which is called Ruby Streak. And there's a green version that's very frondy looking. And then there's some thicker, bigger leaves that are kind of curly and things that give more weight. And those tend to be the more spicy ones.
These are all in the frilly mustard
all
category.
Just basically the mustard category. Because in mustards, you got everything from your big flat leaf, like your red giant or garnet giant mustards that are big, flat, dark red leaves, to all the little super, super skinny things. And now we're starting to discover some other Indian Chinese mustards that are medium wide leaves, really fat stems, all sorts of things that have different flavors and different textures. Great for using raw, great for a very quick saute kind of thing, yeah.
And with the mustards, it's all about the leaf. There really isn't much stem at all. It really is just the leaf.
The only ones that have stems that are usable now are these ones we've just discovered, which are called Chinese horn mustards. And when they're really big in a bunch, like you're gonna let them go for a while, the stem will be white and kind of ribbed and can be up to like 4 inches wide at the bottom. We tend to not have a lot of those right now, but we're going to try and do more because they're amazing because the stem is actually not spicy. compared to the leaf. The leaf can be extremely spicy on that one. And again, the whole thing can be like a foot long. I mean, really big, really mm-hmm. big. And they're
big,
just
flat leaf.
Big, flat, kind mm-hmm. of curled, bent over, and then this funny kind of ribbed, humpy stem. I mean, they're just an incredibly beautiful plant. You would want it just to look at just because it's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. And to eat a large mustard leaf or something, would it? How do you do that? How do you prepare it?
I shred them up or julienne them. I mm-hmm. take the stem off mm-hmm. and then just, as I say, either julienne them up with a knife or just shred them by hand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then how do you like to serve them?
Mixed in with anything else that's around.
A dressing of some sort?
Yeah, usually a mustard vinaigrette or something like that will work. A lemon vinaigrette with some mustard added.
Mm-hmm. Something a little spicy.
Spoiled. Yeah, I'm spoiled. Bill makes a really good vinaigrette with a lot of mustard and stuff in it. And so I'm kind of, I don't have to do that. I bring in the bowl of stuff and he does the dressing.
It.
He dresses it.
And then you guys just chow down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And mustard seems to go really well with menus when you have like rich meat, mm-hmm. pork, lamb, mm-hmm. all those things. The mustard sets it off. It's kind of like a cleanser to the palate mm-hmm. with when you have rich food.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and just grabbing a little leaf off of that beautiful display of yours and just popping it in the mouth, it's just so refreshing.
Yeah. So it's amazing.
Yeah. It's wonderful stuff. Well, thank you so much for growing it and doing what you do, and thanks for the info about the family of mustards.
Thank you.
That was Barbara Spencer. She is co-owner of Windrose Farm with she and her husband, Bill, up in Paso Robles. And her booth, she's got another one of these booths. It's just a gorgeous place to come and visit and look and talk to Barbara and her helpful staff and snag a little mustard leaf when she's not looking. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
In a minute, we take a deep dive into the commercial fishing industry. Don't turn that dial. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Trust the Gorton's fishermen, the slogan goes. Truth be told, if you were to eat a McDonald's Filet-O-Fish sandwich in Alaska, the fish inside the breading has crossed the continental U.S. twice on its journey to Gloucester, Mass., where it's sliced and coated, then it's returned to the Golden Arches back west. Lee Vandervoo dives into the commercial fishing industry where she discovers monopolies, privatization, and exclusion are just as rampant on the oceans as they are in America's heartland. Could you talk about the current state of the fishing industry where words like sustainable and eco-friendly are brandished around and have propelled the, quote, slow fish movement?
Sure. I think the assumption we make when we're talking about sustainable seafood is that, you know, we're talking about a fish that was caught in a small boat, and that boat was probably owned by its operator, and that operator is probably a small business. But seafood is actually becoming increasingly industrial and more of a wage job, and the industry is transitioning from being run by small businesses to being run by corporations and investors. It's not very intuitive, but this is actually where the push for sustainable seafood is taking us in the United States. And the slow food movement, and within it the slow fish movement, is kind of rising from the voice of marginalized fishers who really want to take back coastal sovereignty.
So just to clarify, the corporate move into fisheries, are they discounting sustainability?
No, not at all. Actually, it comes from a new policy push towards sustainability in the U.S. that began around 2010. How it happened was through a regulatory change in the way that the U.S. puts limits on how much seafood can be caught. Those limits make sure that any fish that you catch this year can be there next year, be there in 10 and 20 years. So beginning in 2010, the government started to favor a new political tool called catch shares. How it works is that the government took the pie, if you will, of all the fish that can be caught, and they sliced it up and they gave it away in ownership to private fishermen or to corporations in some cases, or boat owners. And it became a privatized marketplace. And that was in the spirit of enforcing these caps. But what has happened is that ownership has meant good stewardship for some fishermen, and it's meant becoming landlords for lots of others. So we've moved to this place in the U.S. seafood industry, where lots of people who are out on the ocean now, they're renting their rights to be there from ocean landlords, and it's pushing down wages. It's making very hard for people to climb the top of the industry. So when these properties are up for sale, what you get then is you get seafood properties gravitating toward the deeper and deeper pocket, hence investors, corporations, really starting to take over more of this marketplace.
So let's say you're a fisherman who has been fishing for generations, and you have a boat, and you either didn't get into the marketplace at the beginning, or you don't have the wherewithal to purchase a share. How can you still be part of the game?
Well, there are some folks who are marginalized and they continue to fish in what remains, which are very small set-asides for common properties. But a lot of cases where the whole industry has been privatized, those folks are just out of luck. If you didn't get in, you sell your boat and you take your retirement check and you go do something else. That's why we see a lot of people who are renting the access to stay in. So some of these owners, they got tremendous seafood properties and they turn around, they lease the right to go and catch that seafood to somebody else who's going to give them 50 to 80% of the revenue just for the opportunity to go back to work. So that's what we see a lot of folks who didn't get in doing.
Can you like spool that out for me a little more? Let's say Louise owns the share and Joe is the one that sort of turned in his boat and now he's going to work for Louise.
Yeah, Joe can keep his own boat to go work for Louise. In fact, Louise, really, she doesn't want that overhead anymore. You know, boats are expensive. You got to pay insurance on them. She doesn't want any of those responsibilities because she's got the access to the fish, right? So she can make money and she can just stay home on the couch and Joe's going to give her 50%, maybe as much as 80% of the revenue from whatever fish she owns, depending on what she owns, just for the right to go back to work. Joe's going to earn a good living, but Louise is going to do really good.
Does Louise ever go on the boat? Is she forced to go on the boat?
You know, interestingly, in Alaska, in the halibut and sablefish industry, sometimes we call that fish black cod or butterfish, regulators tried to create some rules to make it so that these properties actually stayed in the hands of working fishermen. They call it the boots on deck rule. And it's if your fish are being caught, you have to be on the boat. And they had hoped that would create an atmosphere in which, you know, fishermen would sell their properties as they aged out. What happened instead is that there's become this really lucrative marketplace for getting that guy on your boat. So the beginning of the halibut season, you'll see them like brightly colored flyers going out in the mail, advertising all kinds of perks on the boats just to get these guys to ride on where rental crews will then fish their fish for them. So things like saunas, staterooms, quality grub, movies, DVD collections, big screen TVs, anything to keep people on the boat, keep them happy. And I've been on one of these vessels where, you know, the landlord is, he's there. Sometimes he pitches in, but for the most part, he can do anything he wants. And he still is going to make 65% of the revenue on that boat while the crew fishes for his catch.
Your focus has been on the brand Gulf Wild. What distinguishes them in the industry and how do they fit into the supply chain?
The thing that I love about Gulf Wild is those are the folks that got hold of these properties and really did become the incredible stewards that everybody who pushed for this policy hoped everyone would be when catch shares were created. These are folks that banded together around the Gulf of Mexico, around grouper and red snapper properties and said, we want to make the best, most traceable, sustainable seafood in the world. And you know, they've done it. They've developed a really incredible system to track each individual fish from where it comes from in the water, what boat it rides in on, what kind of gear harvests it, the people that bring it to shore, through the distribution chain to wherever it lands with the consumer, be it in a restaurant or in a grocery store. That's a pretty incredible feat. And they take proceeds off of what they earn, and they do get a premium on their product, and they reinvest it back in conservation in the Gulf of Mexico. Those are the incredible things that private owners can do in these types of systems if they're people who want to innovate. It's just a question of where these properties land. Nobody is forced to do this. They wanted to do it.
Are quotas different for the type of fish being caught, or Are they different in designated waters, and do they fluctuate from year to year?
They do fluctuate a lot. They fluctuate based on science. So, you know, we've had pretty firm limits on how much fish can come out of the water in the U.S. for some time. And since 2006, federal law has been you have to actually tie that to science. So every year that's reevaluated and the pie changes a little bit. The idea with catch shares is that, you know, you become a good steward, your share of the pie gets bigger because there are more fish. We have seen fish rebound through these policies, but they're like hard scientific caps on any fish that could come out of the water anywhere. It's common sense. Just don't catch too many and they'll, you know, the populations rebound.
How are limits enforced and regulated?
Limits are enforced and regulated very loosely through the federal government, through, you know, Coast Guard, law enforcement of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and through the regulators that keep tabs on these programs. I think there are some gaps in their ability to enforce the rules and the actual rules that have become apparent in these programs, but they are its stewards.
So you ask in your book, who owns these fish? What did you conclude?
I don't think it's the public anymore. You know, every other natural resource in the U.S. that we lease to private interests, say timber or, you know, land for wind or solar farms, mines, any of that that comes from public lands, those are leases that expire. In this case, we're starting to see properties that were once public properties, fish, if you will, the rights to go and catch them, traded every day on private markets, and the public is getting no benefit from that trading and from the massive economy that's been built around this stuff. I would say that's a private marketplace and that the U.S. Citizens really have lost control of the ownership of their seafood.
Lee Vandervoo's new book is The Fish Market. We close out the show eating food with a view here in L.A. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. It's time for the weekly restaurant review from our favorite food critic, Jonathan Gold. Are you taking us somewhere very special today?
Well, someplace very high in the air.
High in the air. That's nice. We're talking about 71 Above, right?
Right, which is downtown in what longtime Angelenos still persist in calling the Library Tower.
So are we 71 stories?
Yeah, it's on the 71st floor. You're looking literally down on the roofs of every other building in the city, including, you know, the new tower that's supposed to be the tallest.
Wow. The room, is it clubby with huge banks of windows? What does it feel like?
It's all windows. The restaurant space is all 360 degrees. I'm not sure there's seating in all of that, but you're sort of seated at a place. There's like a little thing that tells you what direction you're pointing. So if you want to know if you're facing northwest or southeast, it will tell you. The waiter is very good at pointing out favorite landmarks.
Oh, I love that.
I think it'd be great when the Dodgers are playing, looking down onto Dodger Stadium.
So how did your meal take form?
It is, in the evenings, a three-course tasting menu, a smallish first course, a slightly larger second, and a slightly bigger third. And then you can get dessert if you want to for a supplement. I think they've figured out that we are in the era of shared desserts. And then not really everybody has to have the mammoth chocolate thing.
Yeah, everybody likes a plate in the middle and a million forks or spoons.
Yeah. You probably would call it French or European or international fancy pants. A lot of the ideas were familiar a decade ago, which isn't necessarily bad. I mean, just because fashions have gone beyond, you know, horseradish snow doesn't mean that horseradish snow is not a good thing.
I think it's always a good thing.
Yeah.
Give us an idea of what some of your choices were for the three courses.
Some of the first courses I liked best, there was a poached oyster with a lobe of uni on, a little bit of tarragon. It was lightly poached. It was like a single, slithery, highly marine mouthful with like just a little bit of funky edge from the uni, a tiny bit of salt from what must have been the amount of caviar you could move with a eyedropper. The fried egg is – I didn't eat the egg part. Okay, I admit it. But I had everything but the egg. It comes on sort of a forced meat of potato and chorizo, and there's like little things of finger lime that like pop in your mouth. That's nice. The sunchoke soup seems to be a standard. I think the best thing I ever had there was a – parsnip. Is the parsnip still on the menu? I don't know. But it was like a fat parsnip cooked. It was glazed with duck fat at the end and served under a heap of flowers. What looked like powdered sugar was powdered duck fat. Again, like one of those modernist techniques, right? There's a binder that you mix with the liquid duck fat and it looks like that. There's a little chilled labneh because everybody has to be Middle Eastern now. There were different herbs and chunks of roasted pistachio, which are also a thing. And it looked like a dessert. And it was a vegetable, but when you ate it, a lot of the sensations were of eating a duck.
And then one of the thirds. Pick a third, any third.
I'd have to go with the suckling pig, which I know surprises you. I mean, you get all that for $70.
That is quite reasonable.
And the wine list is fairly well priced, and they have interesting cocktails. And at some of the small plates, super loud, grungy restaurants, once you end up getting everything, it's going to be close to that anyway.
Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is dining at 71 Above this week in downtown LA. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many, many thanks to the Good Food team. They are
Abby Fentress-Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine, Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
Ronnie Mickelson.
And once again, Phil Richards. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.